It would be unusual for a board that deals with social policy to be a board composed entirely of men.
The state's boards and commissions are overpopulated with men. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, November 5th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Pebble brings its case against the EPA to Congress.
They launched this process against us because they'd always planned to kill this project, particularly Phil North.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. Alaska Pacific University is accepting applications for all undergraduate programs for the spring 2016 semester. More at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
Women are underrepresented in state boards and commissions. These groups, comprised of experts, citizens, and officials, guide state policy, make regulations, and protect Alaskans in areas from hairdressing to the permanent fund. This past summer, KTOO collected data on Alaska's 134 boards and commissions to which the governor makes appointments. Only a third of the members are women. Lisa Fu takes a closer look at the state's new Marijuana Control Board, formed in July, which has no women.
Kim Cole is a 41-year-old mother and high school science teacher in Anchorage. Last year, she was also the face of a parent coalition campaigning for regulating marijuana like alcohol. Literally, her face was on campaign posters, newspaper ads, the web, coupon mailers.
There definitely was a little bit of backlash.
Cole says she and her school district received emails and complaints calling on her to resign as a teacher. But she received more support than negativity.
I actually had random people stop me in cars and say, hey, that was really brave of you. I'm glad that you're doing that. Thank you. So I thought that was actually really, really cool to get that kind of a response. And the nasty grams and the nasty emails that I got from random people that I didn't know, it's going to happen. You can't please everybody.
After the initiative passed, Cole became a board member of the Coalition for Responsible Cannabis Legislation and the Alaska Marijuana Industry Association. She's also the Alaska chapter chair of Women Grow and organizes monthly events where people learn about various aspects of the industry from experts and professionals.
The idea is basically to encourage women to be part of the cannabis industry because we want it to be the first industry where women really have an equal footing. In any other industry, that hasn't been the case.
The hope for gender equality within the industry doesn't hold up for the board responsible for regulating the industry or deciding who gets a license. Governor Bill Walker appointed 5 men to the Marijuana Control Board. That's despite the fact that almost a third of the 131 applicants were women, and 7 of them were interviewed. Cole was one of them. Her interview lasted about an hour, and she left feeling good about it. She says she applied for the board to offer a unique voice.
Coming as somebody who's a little bit younger, who, you know, comes from a different demographic, who has children, who works with children, it's definitely just a different perspective and a different lens to look at this whole industry.
The initial board had to include 2 members from the marijuana industry, 1 from public safety, 1 from public health, and 1 from a rural area. Governor Walker says he struggled with staying within these requirements.
And that was probably the toughest board for me to select.
Walker says he's sensitive to gender equity and takes that into consideration in all appointments. But only a third of the roughly 100 board and commission appointments he's made since becoming governor are women.
I think we can certainly improve on that. Absolutely, we can. And I think that if you look in our administration, I think you'll see that we've done a good job on that as well.
8 members of his 23-person cabinet are women. Walker says he wasn't comfortable with appointing an all-male board. There was a woman in Anchorage he hoped to get on the Marijuana Control Board. He didn't recall her name, but he says another form of diversity took precedence.
I wanted somebody from Southeast or somebody from Juneau. There's somebody from Fairbanks or somebody from Anchorage. So regional is important to me as well, that there's a regional representation.
For the rural seat, Walker appointed a Bethel man. For public safety, he chose a Soldotna man. The appointments must be confirmed by a majority of the Alaska legislature, but a deadline is coming up before that. By November 24th, this initial all-male board is responsible for adopting regulations for how the industry is going to operate. It controls the cultivation, manufacture, and sale of marijuana in Alaska. That's a big deal.
Very, very, very big job. I will agree with you. It's huge.
That's Cynthia Franklin, director of the Marijuana Control Board and the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. She thinks regional diversity on the board is especially important at this early stage.
If you had a board that was mostly Anchorage and Juneau, or even Anchorage, Juneau, and Fairbanks, that didn't have representation from some of those small and medium-sized areas, then you might get rules that would work for one area of the state, but that wouldn't work for another area of the state.
Amy Lovecraft finds having an all-male marijuana control board troubling.
It would be unusual for a board that deals with social policy and health policy to be a board composed entirely of men.
Lovecraft is a political science professor at University of Alaska Fairbanks. She teaches courses on law and society, which involves looking at gender issues.
When you're dealing with, in particular, policies that may affect men and women and may affect, you know, youth, girls and boys, may affect our elders, men and women all differently, those kinds of boards should make, in my mind, a special effort to have gender diversity.
The Marijuana Control Board isn't the only all-male state board. There are 12 others. Most of the members on these boards were originally appointed by other governors. Walker's most recent appointment was Attorney General Craig Richards to the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation Board of Trustees, which is also all male. That's another board Lovecraft thinks should have some women.
Can both genders have equal expertise in the gender concerns of the other to represent them in policy? And while I would like to say yes,
we're still not quite there yet, Lovecraft says, and it's best to preserve gender diversity. One member's term on the Marijuana Control Board expires next year. Governor Walker says when further appointments to the board are made, women will be represented. Kim Cole has already submitted her resume. With help from Lakedra Chavis and Jennifer Canfield, I'm Lisa Fu in Juneau.
The University of Alaska Board of Regents yesterday approved a total budget of $960 million for next year, which includes a $350 million request from the state. That's a 7.6% increase over this year's budget and does not take into account a $15.8 million cut recommended by the State Office of Management and Budget. UA President Jim Johnson says he and other university leaders will work to produce a contingency budget in the coming months as the full fiscal picture becomes clear during the upcoming legislative session. Johnson says the contingency budget's goal will be to make more targeted cuts on a case-by-case basis rather than across the board. After public testimony and discussion, the regents also settled on a 5% tuition increase, which will start in the fall 2016 semester. That's down from the original 9% increase proposed at the beginning of the meeting.
It's just so critical from an economic standpoint for our businesses and our communities.
Still to come, Southeast residents weigh in on the importance of a reliable ferry system. That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
proponents of the Pebble Mine in southwest Alaska brought their case to the U.S. House today. Pebble says the EPA collaborated with mine opponents to restrict the project in what the company calls a preemptive veto because Pebble hasn't applied for federal permits yet. As APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, Pebble got a sympathetic ear from the Republicans on the House Science, Space, and Technology Committee.
This hearing wasn't really about the mine, it was about process. Specifically, whether the EPA used an objective process to restrict the mine, or whether the agency just went through the motions to reach a predetermined conclusion. Pebble CEO Tom Collier says he was outraged when he read through a stack of emails between EPA staff and mine opponents.
What I found was collusion between the decision makers and environmental activists. And we can't allow that in this country.
Tribes from Bristol Bay say the EPA intervened after they requested help. Collier says the EPA emails show the agency collaborated with the tribes even on that request.
They launched this process against us because they'd always planned to kill this project, particularly Phil North. And he's helping draft the petitions that he then said were the reasons why he initiated this process.
North was a Kenai-based EPA biologist who retired and went sailing around the world. Or, as Collier put it, fled the country to evade subpoenas regarding his work to block Pebble. The Republican leadership of the committee didn't pretend this hearing would be an open-minded search for the truth. They declared the EPA biased before it started. Here's the title they gave the hearing: Examining EPA's Predetermined Efforts to Block the Pebble Mine. Republicans put only friendly questions to Collier. For instance, here's one from Representative Gary Palmer of Alabama.
It's very apparent that the playbook is already laid out and has less to do with establishing the actual science or determining the actual impacts of the project or conducting objective analysis, and more to do with appealing to politics and optics to achieve a certain outcome at the EPA. Would you agree with that?
I do agree, Congressman.
Democrats, of course, tossed their own softballs for the sole witness against the mine, former state senator Rick Halford. While Collier emphasized process, Halford spoke passionately about Bristol Bay.
This is the last greatest salmon resource left on Earth.
No one from EPA testified, but former Defense Secretary William Cohen did. He produced a report for Pebble, finding the process unfair, but he didn't go as far as saying the EPA collaborated with mine opponents. Cohen urged the committee to use its subpoena power to find out more than he could. Watching the hearing behind the witnesses was a contingent from Bristol Bay.
I just think that this whole committee meeting was a sham, coordinated between Pebble Partnership and the Republican House majority.
Werner Wilson is a commercial fisherman and a volunteer for United Tribes of Bristol Bay. He says Pebble should apply for the permits already and get its plan out in the open. And Wilson says he sees nothing wrong with the EPA communicating with the tribes.
Of course, a government agency is going to talk with people. They've talked with all sides.
Mine opponents say Pebble should design a project that complies with the EPA's restrictions, such as losing no more than 5 miles of fish streams, and let the permit process begin. Collier, though, says they have to get the EPA's preemptive veto lifted before applying for permits. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
4 Haines residents survived a plane crash yesterday afternoon and swam through 5-foot seas to get to the rocky shore. 3 were released from a Juneau hospital, while the 4th is still in critical condition in Seattle. The privately owned Cessna 180 went down shortly before 2 p.m. and crashed into Lynn Canal near Eldred Rock, about 50 miles north of Juneau and 30 miles from Haines. KHNS's Jillian Rogers has more.
The U.S. Coast Guard got the request for assistance at 1:45 p.m. on Wednesday, according to Petty Officer Meredith Manning. The Federal Aviation Administration heard the Mayday call from the pilot, identified by Alaska State Troopers as Michael Makoviak. Makoviak reported that the plane's engine had died while flying to Haines from Juneau. The plane crashed into Lynn Canal and the 4 swam to a rocky beach north of Berners Bay on the east side of the canal in the vicinity of Eldred Rock. A Coast Guard MH-60 Jayhawk helicopter was dispatched and picked up three passengers, while a Temsco helicopter picked up the fourth. All were brought to Juneau. Manning said seas at the time of the crash were at 5 feet, while winds were around 28 miles per hour. The call came in at 1:45, and the four were located by rescuers at 3:25 p.m. Here's Manning talking about the scene when rescuers arrived.
All four of the survivors had swam to shore, and the plane was no longer visible in the water.
The Coast Guard also diverted a 45-foot response boat from Juneau. All passengers were seen at Bartlett Regional Hospital, but one was later transferred to Seattle Hospital, while the other three were treated and released on Wednesday evening. Harborview Medical Center spokesperson Susan Gregg said Thursday morning that Martha Makoviak is still in critical condition in the intensive care unit. Gregg said Martha is receiving round-the-clock care and monitoring. Troopers confirmed that Michael and Martha were on board along with two juveniles, all from Haines. Sean Williams is the lead investigator from the National Transportation Safety Board charged with looking into the crash. He said Thursday morning that once the search and rescue aspect of the accident was over, he began the initial phase of the investigation into why the plane went down. Collecting evidence is a challenge as the plane is currently submerged in Lynn Canal.
The NTSB does not do recovery. That's up whether or not there was insurance or up to the individual if they wish to go after the aircraft.
Williams said without the plane to comb through, he will conduct interviews, look at maintenance records and the pilot's flight history to get more clues into the probable cause.
And try and recreate as much of the information and as possible as far as how the airplane was configured, maybe what sounds or what vibrations, if any, that sort of thing.
Williams said the preliminary report on the crash will be released in 5 to 10 days and a factual report in 6 to 12 months. Reporting in Haines, I'm Jillian Rogers.
Lack of physical evidence continues to be an issue at the Fairbanks 4 hearing. Three pieces of possible evidence were raised yesterday during an ongoing hearing into whether George Freese, Kevin Pease, Marvin Roberts, and Eugene Vent were wrongly convicted of the 1997 beating death of John Hartman. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Marvin Roberts' uncle discredited a claim he disposed of a pair of blood-stained shoes from the Hartman attack. Kenny Mayo was responding to an allegation earlier in the hearing made by a former girlfriend that he threw bloody shoes from his nephew in a dumpster hours after Hartman was found with mortal injuries attributed to being kicked and stomped. Mayo told the court he doesn't remember any such shoes.
If something like that happened as memorable, such as that, I would remember it. That did not occur. That did not happen.
Also Wednesday, a state investigator testified that the hood of Marvin Roberts' long-impounded car was shipped to a Lower 48 forensics lab for testing. The 1992 sedan is alleged to be the vehicle that transported Roberts, George Freese, Kevin Pease, and Eugene Vent to and from the Hartman attack scene. State Trooper investigator Lance Dahlke testified that when reviewing case evidence last year, he decided to see if apparent dirt stains on Hartman's corduroy pants matched a smudge on the car's hood.
I felt there was nothing to lose at that point, and so I personally took the hood off the car, went and got a hood box, and packaged the box or the hood up.
Dahlke says he shipped the hood and pants to an Illinois-based laboratory for analysis. The state did not share test results indicating they came back negative. Fairbanks 4 legal team attorney Rick Allen read a portion of the lab report undermining the existence of dirt on the pants.
Closer examination of these regions show that the color was due to wear rather than heavy deposits of dust. You see that?
Yes, sir, I do.
So what you initially thought was dirt on the pants was not actually dirt, but was wear in the pants.
The only other new evidence noted by Dahlke was a crumpled $10 bill he says he found in the crack between the front passenger seat and door edge of Robert's car. The state presented the money as cash possibly taken from Hartman. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on Condor.com. Condor, born to fly. And by the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence. Alaska Pacific University is accepting applications for all undergraduate programs for the spring 2016 semester. More at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
The Interior Energy Project is moving forward. Last night, finalists for an effort to bring natural gas to Fairbanks made public presentations at Pioneer Park. As KUAC's Robert Hannon reports, a finalist will be selected in December.
Wednesday, the Fairbanks public heard from five finalists vying to partner in the Interior Energy Project, an initiative to bring natural gas to Fairbanks. The companies that presented were Harvest Alaska LLC, Phoenix Clean Fuels LLC, Salic Incorporated, Spectrum LNG LLC, and Westpac Midstream. Karsten Rodvik is with the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, or ADA, which will make the final selection. He says the next step in the process comes up soon.
We expect to come to our board of directors, ADA's board, in December with a recommendation for partner selection.
One of the hosts for the forum was the Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation. President and CEO Jim Dodson says recent events augur well for getting gas to Fairbanks economically. 2 weeks ago, the Federal Railroad Administration gave Alaska Railroad the okay to transport liquefied natural gas by rail. And Dodson says the Walker administration's proactive efforts on energy are especially important.
You need to have state support. Today, there is no community in Alaska that has affordable energy that has not had it subsidized.
This summer, Governor Walker signed House Bill 105 into law, legislation that aims to spur getting affordable gas to Fairbanks markets. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Port community leaders worry next summer's ferry schedule will be as unreliable as this summer's. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports from yesterday's Marine Highway teleconference.
Budget cuts and mechanical breakdowns left many of this year's passengers stranded, dropping destinations, or switching to air travel. Town leaders say that hurt tourism, especially small-town excursions, restaurants, and bed and breakfasts. Wrangell Economic Development Director Carol Rushmore said she's being asked whether it will happen again.
It's just so critical from an economic standpoint for our businesses and our communities that if we have all these cancellations in July and August, it'll just be disastrous.
Small communities dependent on the Alaska Marine Highway were the hardest hit, since they had fewer alternatives. Pelican Mayor Patricia Phillips said officials need to have backup plans when ferries break down.
It's essential to reschedule canceled service due to mechanicals or scheduling changes. We have, freight out here waiting to ship out, so it's important to reschedule that service.
It's a worry in more than Southeast. Prince William Sound, for example, faces significant service cuts with its fast ferry tied up next year. Alaska Travel Industry Association President Sarah Leonard said a third of her 700-member businesses are in ferry ports.
The changes to the schedule last summer resulted in a 14% decline in non-resident travel on the ferry, and members told us that they lost thousands of dollars in business due to the rebookings and cancellations.
Alaska Marine Highway officials said they're doing their best to design a schedule that can be maintained. That's the reason for the deep reductions proposed for next summer, which reflect a $25 million budget cut. Transportation Department Deputy Commissioner Mike Neusel says everything depends on legislative funding.
There's always risk and uncertainty there. I will do my best in testifying and communicating that it's important that we lock that schedule in and actually fund the schedule we publish.
Neusel and other ferry officials say they'll make some changes in the draft schedule for next summer. It should be complete in December. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting in Juneau.
Hundreds of teachers from across the state convened in Sitka last month for the Alaska Math and Science Conference. This was the first time the biennial Professional Development Summit was held in Southeast. Several sessions addressed how teachers can keep curriculum culturally relevant and fun while still helping students meet new educational standards. KCAW's Brielle Schaefer reports.
In the past, Blatchley Middle School teacher Bridget Whitcomb had to order all of the meteorites for her earth science classes from the internet.
On eBay, you can buy lots of meteorites, and so the kids get to see the meteorites I buy online.
But
you can't buy moon rocks online.
After the Alaska Math and Science Conference, she'll be able to borrow tiny pieces of the moon from the Johnson Space Center in Houston, Texas. Whitcomb and dozens of other Alaska teachers became certified to check out the materials from NASA. Part of that process involved playing games they could use in their own classrooms. In one, they identified pictures of moon fissures in lunar soil, or regolith. They also tested an artificial Mars soil.
It feels like sand is more coarse than the black.
And they talked about how these space rocks could fit into their lesson plans and potential new educational standards.
These are just some of the next generation science standards that it covers. Physical science, the history of our planet, physics if you teach high school.
That's NASA educator Maria Chambers, who taught the seminar. So far, 14 states and the District of Columbia have adopted the controversial standards. Alaska is not among them. The new, more rigorous state standards for math and teacher accountability were big topics during the sessions. The conference's theme, after all, was navigating the tides of change. Organizer Rebecca Himshute, who teaches science at Keetgushiheen Elementary School, says there are so many variables in education right now. That's why conferences like this one are so important.
Standards are one part of the conversation. A much bigger part of the conversation at a conference like this is teachers teaching other teachers how best to get kids to those standards.
Himshute says there are going to be a couple rough years ahead as educators learn how to teach to the higher standards.
We want to get from A to B as fast as possible, and it's not going to be a straight line. We need a little bit of time, and we need opportunities like we've had this weekend to help teachers find the best ways to make the greatest gains we can as fast as we can with kids without taking the fun out of it and without forcing kids to do things that they don't find valuable.
Educators are also being evaluated on their students' learning. Eventually, they'll be judged on how they make subjects culturally relevant. To that end, the conference had sessions on how to incorporate math and science into Iditarod lesson plans and how to use moose population case studies in science classes. All in all, teachers seemed pleased with the new state standards. Matt Hunter, who teaches math and science at Mount Edgecombe High School, says the new expectations have not changed how he teaches.
I see the standards as a resource, but I don't see them as a threat at all. I still do what I judge to be best for my students.
The next Alaska Math and Science Conference will be in 2017 in Fairbanks. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Brielle Schaefer.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Lisa Fu, Lakedra Chavis, Jennifer Canfield and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Josh Edge in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Jillian Rogers in Haines, Dan Bross and Robert Hannon in Fairbanks, and Brielle Schaefer in Sitka. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Ron Zastro. Monica Goki is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Crowley, providing marine petroleum distribution and energy support services throughout Alaska since 1953, supporting business development while helping safeguard the environment. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
And by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
And by
BP Alaska, as part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com.
And by
the University of Alaska Southeast, with schools of arts and sciences, management, education, and career education in Juneau, Ketchikan, and Sitka. UAS, a learning community on campus and online. More at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.